market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special Sunday mailbag edition. Yep, one day there'll be a different intro for Sunday mailbags, but not today because it's still special. It's still a mailbag and, well, still an episode, I suppose. I'm Scott Phillips, believe it or not, and with me is the straw man himself, Andrew Page. How are you, buddy?
I'm very good, sir. Yourself?
I'm exceptionally well. I'm encouraged by the launch of Strawman Premium that you were telling us about on Friday. Mm-hmm. By now, for all we know, the doors are closed, you're full or not. So if people want to go to strawman.com, they can at least see if there are still options to join. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, again, as you know, we are pre-recording, so anything can happen in the next
exactly.
3 days.
And probably but, will.
Yeah. I mean, we're well over halfway and only 8 hours in. So it's, look, whatever happens from here, we know we've got a bit of a, we've got a pretty cool inner call that we're going to hit the ground running. So I'm pretty stoked. But yeah, even if we are full, there's you know, you can manage a play money portfolio. You can use Strawman as an investment diary. So we'd invite you to come along and check it out either way.
There you go, strawman.com. Of course, mate. I work for The Motley Fool, fool.com.au, where we try and pick some stocks. So hopefully we'll continue to beat the market. So far, so good. Andrew, of course, is a former Motley Fool employee and a friend of The Fool for Life. And we're very, very pleased that he's joined us on the podcast. Because, mate, can I tell you, despite my best efforts, people are still happy to see you back. So I guess I've got to just accept what I'm dealt with. I thought I was the star around here, but it turns out people care about you more than me, which I'm not even slightly bitter about. And that's encouraging.
Thank you very much, mate. I just get into the email account before you do and delete all the bad ones.
So nice.
That's the secret there.
It helps. Plus, you've got a big family, and, you know, if all your family write in and say how wonderful you are, then I suppose, you know, that's going to happen.
It is a mate, Catholic background, so. Yeah.
Exactly. We got a heap of questions, as always, mate, so let's get on with it. Here's a really simple one with a potentially complex answer, so I'm going to ask you for it. Peter says, hey, Scott, I've got a question for the pod, perhaps. Can you explain why the net asset value per share varies compared to the share price of a listed fund? And he gives an example where a company's got a $1.99 net asset value but is selling for $1.80. Now, Andrew, I'm going to start you off with a challenge. I'm going to make you sort of define our terms. So what is the net asset value and why should it be something correlated to the share price?
Oh, man, it's one of those really easy questions, but it's also one that, you know, as you dig into, things can get complicated. But at a high level, it's really basic. Every business has a balance sheet. Everything they've, you know, that they, all the assets and cash that they own versus all the things that they owe to other people.
Yep.
And the net difference is the net assets, and, you know, or it's otherwise known as the equity of the business. And it depends on the type of business. Some businesses are very asset intensive. You need a tractor, you need a truck, you need a factory, that kind of thing. Other businesses don't really have much tangible assets. If you're an accounting practice, you've got a coffee machine, a photocopier, and a laptop type thing.
Right.
So in some situations, it makes sense for the share price to be similar to the net asset value because maybe that's the only value that's there. Mm-hmm. But really, and this is more and more true these days, the value of a business is more than the sum of its parts. It's the enterprise capacity of all of the employees and management that are there. It's what they can, what value they can deliver and therefore get paid for. So most companies trade well above their net asset value and they should.
Right.
So, and don't forget the value you have in terms of your net asset value is only sort of worked out once a year when the accountants put the balance sheet together and the share price is going to change every day. So, some people like to sort of go for these, what Buffett called cigar butts, where you can find situations where the share price is really close to or below net asset value, which means that even if the business doesn't do that well at all, there's a bit of security in knowing that with the right management team, they might just wrap the business up, sell all the assets, pay off the debts, and then distribute what's left over to shareholders.
Yep.
That doesn't always happen because people tend to like, you know, going out with a fight, but yeah. Is that's a high level answer? What would you expand on there?
So I think that's exactly right. In this case, I think the question is being asked about a listed investment company, and if you're a fund or an investment company, it makes sense that your asset value should roughly correspond with your share price, right? Because let's say you are an investment fund, and your business is taking money and investing that money, and your share price should be correlated with the ownership of those assets. If I was, let's keep it very, very simple. If I had the Scott and Andrew Investment Fund and it was listed on the ASX and we invested in cash and we had $100 of cash in this investment business, you should expect, so the net asset value would be $100, makes sense, right? All we do is cash and we've got it there and it's in the bank. So our asset value, our net asset value is $100. you should assume if you added all those shares together, you'd be silly to pay $110 for $100 in cash. And if the shares were only worth $70, well, someone would say, hang on, I can buy the whole business for $70 and get $100 in cash. So there's an upside there. So the natural arbitrage should see the net asset value and the share price kind of trade in tandem, right? Because a big discount or a big premium, and the market should sort those out. Fair to say?
Mm. Yeah, I think all else being equal, but you do have to factor in the optionality of that $100. You could
be... And that's where we get to. Exactly. Go on.
Well, you could be a genius capital allocator and you're going to take that $100 and you're going to invest it in all kinds of different things and you're going to grow it into a much larger amount than it is today. So that's what you're paying for. Sometimes you actually see some listed investment companies trade a bit below it and actually stay there for a while, which has got to be a little bit impactful to the managers of the business.
But right, right.
You would expect, all else being equal, that gap to close. But I think it's also natural to see it usually trade at a premium, as I say, for that optionality.
Yeah, I think this is where when you talk about a listed investment company, then you're actually adding together the value of the assets it owns, which kind of should have some of that optionality built in, right? Let's say we didn't have $100 in cash, we had $100 in BHP shares. You should expect that the BHP share price and our asset price for the fund would trade roughly the same because, again, those assets are absolutely manageable and comparable on the market. Mm. You can simply say, well, hang on, I know what these are selling for. So, again, if you had $100 worth of BHP shares in the fund and the fund's selling for $70, you should be able to go, well, hang on, I can buy the fund cheaper than BHP, so I'll do that. Or if the fund's selling for more, someone's going to say, well, hang on, why would I pay $110 for $100 worth of BHP shares, I'll buy them directly. So over time, it should be the case, to the question, Peter, that the net asset value should trade roughly the same as the fund value. A couple of things I'll add to your answer, Ram, in a listed investment company or fund context is, firstly, there can be tax obligations that aren't captured in the net asset value. So if they made a big capital gain, if they were to sell those assets, go back to cash, they'd have to pay a tax bill. So $100 worth of assets at today's price might only be, say, $85 after tax. So there's reasons why you might want to pay less because to get that value back, you'd have to pay the tax bill. And so that's important. You also should recognize the cost of managing that particular fund or investment company. If your fund manager is taking out 1% as a fee, if you capitalize that, we won't get into the details of capitalizing it, but effectively if you said, okay, if I'm going to sort of put a dollar value on the full cost of that management, it'll be up to 5, 7, 8, 10% of the fund value in capitalized cost. So those are kind of some of the reasons why you might see it trade at a slightly different price or different value. All things being equal, it should be pretty close, but that's when you will see it. I think they're the only really significant reasons I can think of that make a difference. The other one I would say, by the way, I mean, it's just standard market inefficiency, right? If you've got a small fund or a small company, if you simply don't have enough people following it, then you'd expect that to be the case. Even the big ones, Soul Patts, I own shares, as our listeners well know, often trades at a big discount. And for no really good reason, there's often this thing called a conglomerate discount where investors are in theory saying, well, the assets, I could buy them myself, it'd be cheaper and more liquid and you're probably not going to sell them anyway, so there's some sort of inherent discount in that. Soul Patts has proven over, by the way, 15 plus years, well, over decades probably, it probably deserves a conglomerate premium rather than discount. But again, you know, the market can also just be straight out wrong, and so that's the other reason why that you can't explain it, you can't kind of define it academically or theoretically, but sometimes it's just the way things go.
I would just add to it as well, while it's an interesting observation, it's, and again, as I always say, each to their own, you do you, but for me, it's sort of like it wouldn't be the sole reason as to why I would buy a listed fund, for example, because whatever discount there is probably not going to be, it's like a currency fluctuations.
Florency fluctuation, that's a much better term.
You've got to be careful what I say there. So that's a situation where, again, that's just got to factor in. But over time, if this is a great investment or a poor investment, there are bigger factors at play. Yeah. And I would say that too. So I would want to be buying into a fund because I was a believer in the management and where they were going to take things in the future. Yeah, if I get a nice discount, that's an added reason, but it's just not, I would never have it as my only reason, because something could be at a discount, stay at a discount, and maybe they just run it really badly and you just continue to get a great discount on a declining net asset value over time. So yeah, don't let it be your primary focus or the core of any strategy.
Yep. Good advice. I think that's kind of valuation generally. My question from Gary on a similar but different question, just around market mechanics. And Gary says, hi, Scott. I've got another question for the podcast, the awesome podcast, I should say. Gee, I almost lost that. I should also mention Gary thinks we're awesome. Gary says, we're awesome. We're awesome, Andrew. He says, I just started investing in US shares and my broker offers partial shares. For example, he says, I can buy 1.234 units. I'm curious as to how this works if you're not buying an entire share. Then he goes on to say, also, how do you record your US dividend income? If I leave the dividend in US dollars to reinvest, how do I record this as Australian income? Thanks, Gary. What do you want to do, mate? Do you want to do the dividends or you want to do the partial ownership?
I'll do the partial ownership if you like.
Can you really have a fractional share? How does that actually work?
Well, what you do is that someone's manufacturing a product behind the scenes, and so they'll actually buy a bunch of shares, and then they'll break them up into partial shares, so there'll be some trust structure that sits behind it. So what you're actually getting are units in a trust.
Yeah.
Now, there's a million different ways, I'm sure, that you can set this up.
Yeah.
So I should say, so with Strawman, we've partnered with Upstreet, actually. So we're issuing partial shares to our contributors if they rank well. So yeah, it's a really cool option. And what's nice about it is that, you know, if you wanted to buy a very expensive, when I say expensive, a high priced share like CSL and you didn't have that much money, you could do it. But I would look into, I think it is always worth looking into the detail, what fees are there, what risks are there, where's the legal full beneficial ownership rest, all of that kind of stuff. There's a variety there. Yeah. But overall, providing it's not too onerous and providing there's not really a good reason as to why you wouldn't just buy the shares yourself directly, I think they've got merit.
So I'm going to add to that, mate, only because I do own some US shares and I have in the past had partial shares. I don't for not... No reasons regarded to the partial shares. I sold the company I had partial shares in. I had a dividend reinvestment plan, and in the US, the brokers run the dividend reinvestment, not the companies. And so I think it was Walmart years ago, and I had 38.146 shares or something. So the broker gave me partial shares. In the US, you actually don't own, if you own through a center broker, you don't own the shares in your own legal entity. Okay. You have a beneficial interest, as you say, in the shares held by the registrar on your behalf. And so effectively, I don't want this to sound too dodgy, but I also don't want it to sound too confident because I've said before, I think chess that we have here to protect our interests is a wonderful thing.
It's great.
In the US, if I own some, I own my shares through Charles Schwab, I actually don't own those shares technically as a legal ownership. I have a beneficial interest in them, as you mentioned before, mate.
Right.
So Schwab has...
So if they collapsed, for example, you could potentially lose your shares.
Right. Now, there's insurance scheme and other things behind that, which is why I don't want to make it sound too dodgy. But effectively, because... So I own, let's say I owned 100 shares of Berkshire Hathaway, just to pick the number. It won't be the A-class shares that are trading at hundreds of thousands of dollars.
That'd be nice. Yeah.
It would be lovely. I do own a couple hundred B-class shares, but that's a very different story. I own some Berkshire shares. Let's say I owned 100 of them. I'm entitled to the ownership and the proceeds of those shares, but I don't own them in a legal sense, in the sense that I can say to Berkshire, look, you know, I own 100 of your shares, unless Berkshire themselves issue me the share certificate. Now, what that also means, if I want to buy 101.359 shares and Schwab want to basically allow me to do that, they'll simply take the equivalent amount of money and then promise me that I can get back an appropriate amount of money if and when I want to part company with those shares. So I say to Schwab, hey, sell my 101.359 shares and that will give me the equivalent cash based on the same calculation. But because in the end, I actually don't own the shares anyway in a legal sense, it's kind of like a bank account, right? I know I've got $100 in the bank account. I don't know which $100 are mine specifically. I just know I own $100 worth of the bank's assets. And so that will give me a different $100. If I go and put a $100 note across the counter, when I want it back, they don't keep that $100 note and give it back to me specifically. They give me back another $100 note. And the same with the partial fractional shares. If I buy 101.359 shares, when I want to sell them, they'll give me the cash equivalent at the current share price. So that's how you can have it. It's all pure accounting. It's just bookkeeping. It's kind of useful because it actually highlights the fact that you actually don't own the shares. It's a nice reminder that you can't own a portion of an actual share. So what's going on, which is what prompted Gary's question of why the answer is important.
Yeah.
The dividend income, Gary, I'm not a tax expert, mate. My understanding is that you earn the income at the then exchange rate. So if you were to get $100 US worth of dividends today and the exchange rate was 75 cents, then you would have 133 odd Australian dollars worth of taxable income as of today. I don't know whether you can elect to translate that to Australian income at certain days of the year or at certain times. My understanding is it's always been done at the time of payment. But as always, when it comes to tax questions, we highly recommend you ask your financial advisor, because we're not tax experts, we're not tax accountants, so we can't help you with that one.
Yep.
Anything more on US dividends, mate?
Nope, I think you covered it.
Hey, Gary had a second question. He said, I just read this article online and interested in how you see this as a shareholder. Now, this was a couple of weeks ago and it was about Jeff Bezos blasting into space as Amazon. Well, he's not the CEO anymore. He's handed over the reins. Probably nice timing, because he then decided to go to space. Now, we know nicely, happily, Jeff returned back to Earth safe, well, happy, comfortable. And that was an important thing. But Gary kind of asked an interesting question. Maybe it's not about so much the ability of management or the business choices of management, but whether or not I felt uncomfortable that the guy who runs one of the best, biggest retailers in the world and a company I've got a decent shareholding in as a portion of my own wealth, not large in absolute sense, but, you know, important to my financial future, how I felt about him blasting off into space. Gary, I wasn't super excited about it, can I tell you? He's already handed over the reins, so I kind of get that he's stepping back and stepping aside a little bit. All I'm saying is that if Bezos hadn't come back down because of some horrible, horrible accident, I would have felt poorer as a shareholder. Now, I can't tell him what to do. I can't stop him doing what he wants to do. And hey, if the alternative is he resigns altogether and then does it, I'd rather him still be connected to the company. So yeah, look, given my choice, I would have happily said, look, send someone else. Just, you know, there's other people that are more expendable. Surely, Jeff. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, look, I wasn't stoked about it. Jeff is the soul of the company in a way that some CEOs are. And look, I'm very, very glad he came back. I think my shares are worth more now he's back on Earth. I think Amazon's future is brighter the longer he spends at Amazon as a controlling or at least an influence of one description or another. So yeah, not stoked, but happy to see him come down. Do you have any thoughts, mate, in general on that kind of thing? CEOs taking risks or doing different stuff?
Oh, you can't account for it. I mean, you just want to – I guess a company's more than just a man, more than just a person. So I think a characteristic of a great CEO is that they surround themselves with very capable people as well. So you would That's like to think that Jeff has done that and that things would still be okay. I'm sure Berkshire Hathaway shares, just speaking of them, I'm sure they'll take a hit whenever Warren steps away for whatever reason or Charlie. But at the same time, I think they've built that thing to endure for a long, long time. And I think that's just one of the things that you consider. You know, it's all, the evaluation's always a game of pros and cons. What I will say is a bit of a left field observation. Okay, and I came across this on Twitter. Someone was talking about, I think it was a white paper or something that Bezos wrote about the case for, called The Case for Space, as to why they're going at it. So is this the feverish dreams of a billionaire, you know, doing stupid things that only billionaires can do?
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit. Maybe that's a little bit true. But I've got to say, for anyone who wants to know that, it is a fascinating, articulate, well-reasoned case that for economic, well, partly a little bit of touchy-feely, good of the long-term, you know, future of humanity, Elon Musk kind of stuff, which, you know, maybe you take with a grain of salt, but also pretty hard-nosed too in some of its decisions. And so more about building the rails for space, the architecture for space. So not that itself is going to deliver immediate value, but more about what it enables for the future. And it's just fascinating. And it's what you very rarely hear anyone, particularly CEOs, talk about the future 100 years from today, but talk about it seriously.
Yeah.
And these guys seem to, I mean, I don't know, maybe I get a bit sucked into some of this stuff because I'm a bit of a nerd and I love space. But I feel as though, while on one hand it's a reckless waste of money, and as I say, the feverish dreams of a billionaire, there is something pretty cool about all this stuff as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of tempting to say both, right? Like, there's plenty of these follies that actually do count for things eventually. Whether it's, you know, people would have criticized government spending on technology in the military 70 years ago, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, and all of a sudden the internet comes out of that and everyone's like, oh, that's cool. No, I'm glad we did that. That's pretty awesome. You know, Musk's kind of, you know, SpaceX thing is putting cheaper satellites into the atmosphere and orbit. And as long as...
Oh, Rocket Lab in New Zealand is doing some brilliant stuff with microsatellites. Yeah, exactly. Really cool stuff. Yeah.
Are those things, you know, as you say, I'm pretty sure Elon's not doing something he hates doing because he feels like he should. I'm sure he loves the hell out of it, right? So I'm sure Jeff is the same. And Richard Branson also went to space. It's you know, it's on in earnest. I'm absolutely sure they are loving the hell out of it. But I'm also, I would be remarkably surprised if these things don't end up with net benefits in different, sometimes unforeseeable, unknowable ways, shapes, and forms from this point forward for exactly the reason you mentioned.
But it will be something that is sort of decades away. I would
possibly,
imagine, in terms of the real...
is already happening, right? I mean, the SpaceX stuff and the Rocket Lab stuff is actually already... I mean, Musk can get things into space in a way NASA can't. NASA's using him and others to put payloads into space in super, super cheap ways. Reusable rockets are changing the economics of space, for example, in a way
for sure.
It's not just about I'm no Elon Musk fan, as our listeners well know, but it's not just about his vanity, right? He's changing the economics of satellite deployment, space travel, a whole lot.
I think, and there's a lot of analogies with any new technology. The internet's a great analogy because when it first came about, some people made some money there, but the economics weren't really worked out. And
that's a good point, yeah.
Do you know, it's sort of like the value, the huge, like the ridiculous amount of value that we have seen created in the last decade was because of all the stuff that happened in the 90s and the early part of the 21st century. So I'm not saying that you won't make money in space and that SpaceX will bleed cash for the next decade, but I just think the real money, when this becomes sort of, a genuine, there's a genuine and diverse and large and thriving space industry. Yeah. I think the returns that we're seeing, today are very marginal compared to what the potential is all I'm saying.
It's also worth pointing out there are some things that, I'm not here to defend billionaires. I'm a shareholder in Amazon, so maybe I like Jeff. I certainly am not a fan of Elon Musk, and I could take a lead. Richard Branson, he's done a cool thing. I think he seems like a decent bloke, but, I'm not here to defend or criticise them. I know plenty of people saying, "Oh, billionaires should just pay taxes instead," all that kind of stuff. And I kind of have.
Well, they should pay taxes. Yeah. So should.
Oh yeah. Their point is, if they've got that much money, they should pay more to the government. It's kind of that idea of like, might as well put tax rates up. If there's enough money left to go to space, you're not paying enough taxes. It's a too easy criticism. I think think about Tesla, right, or think about SpaceX. Those things aren't done by General Electric or General Motors. They're not done by Nike. They're not done by Woolworths. It does take individuals with risk tolerance, frankly, with the capacity. I can't imagine any other public company.
You want to use the word visionary, don't you? But that's too strong a word.
Right. But it's that kind of sense of like, but who else is going to put billions of dollars into developing? Right. So Elon's reusable rockets, right? There is nobody. Maybe Boeing might give it a chance at some point. Maybe NASA does it themselves if the US government give them the money, which is really unlikely. Take Elon out of the picture and says, who else now in 2021 has reusable rockets? Well, the answer already is nobody, because no one else is doing it as well as him.
Yeah.
Would it happen? Would it have taken 20, 30, 40 years? And again, maybe it's for nothing. Maybe it's all vanity anyway, because space itself is vanity, and maybe it never generates enough value to justify it. But you kind of need these people who are just outside the realm of normality in terms of just the finances, right? Who else is going to pay the money to put stuff into space? So value somewhere.
Yeah, I think you can make there should be an argument as to this is probably something that belongs more in the domain of government, and maybe there's a more efficient use of capital in the way that we structure things. And I actually really agree with a lot of that. But at the same time, if you say, well, this is the system we have, at least we're in a world, while it's not ideal, at least we're in a world where there are some people, for whatever motivations, good or bad, are at least driving us forward as a species. There's something cool about that. Even if the people involved are flawed in a lot of ways, like all of us.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's the thing, right? Yeah. Anyway, let's move on. Speaking of Berkshire, I was going to ask this question later, mate, but it came up because you mentioned Warren and Charlie and leaving the business. And Jordan just says, "Hi, Scott, I hope you're enjoying the holiday." This is a couple of weeks old, or back now. "One for the mailbag. What's your summarized thesis for buying and owning Berkshire Hathaway stock? Not advice, of course. I just don't recall hearing your explanation, despite mentioning it on numerous occasions. Thanks, Jordan." I do have over mentioned Berkshire. I'm going to try and not mention the other company.
We haven't mentioned the other one that starts with K yet.
No,
so that's impressive.
I will leave the other company. Maybe it's the other company, capital T, capital O, capital C, which, from now on is the other company. Look, it's a fair question. I do own it. I've mentioned a lot. I mean, Warren Buffett is the master investor, the best investor ever. I think I don't even know who would be second place. He's an absolute genius, and his results speak for themselves. And yes, I absolutely own shares. It's also one of the things where I have to and should disclose those things, but I promise you I'm going to have zero impact on the Berkshire Hathaway share price, whether I mention it or not. So I have no interest in mentioning it for the sake of moving the share price. Not that I would anyway, but it wouldn't matter if I was trying to. But yeah, we mentioned a lot because it's kind of a nice, it's an exemplar, for better or worse, of a whole lot of different things, right? And I think that's the key one. Should I kick off and then you want to add? Is that probably the best way to answer this one, Andrew, you reckon?
Look, this is, it's easy for us to sort of, It's so super. You go down such a rabbit hole when we start talking about Buffett and Berkshire. But to answer the question, well, I guess I won't speak on your behalf, but I assume it's just something to do with – it's what you might call a jockey play, right? So, you know, you're basically backing the judgment of Warren and Charlie, and then when they step down, the team that they've built. And that's been a pretty good bet for a very, very long time. So is it going to be the best investment in the world? Probably not. Could you do worse than that? Yep, a lot worse than it. I think you don't need to get more complicated than that. It's because you also know too that they've given probably more than anyone else such transparency into their goals, their approach. You know, there's no mystery. It's not a black box of an investment bank here. They have spent 50 years laying it out for shareholders in as open a manner as they can as to what their approach, strategy, philosophy is. And they've been prosecuting it extremely well. So we know that they're on an approach that works. We know it's definitely within their wheelhouse. We know they've built something that is, we were talking about balance sheets before. I mean, God, this thing is bulletproof. We could have all kinds of economic calamities and, you know, barring the absolute collapse of civilization, this will be one of the last businesses standing just because it's so conservatively run, So would you look back in 10 years and can you guarantee that you're going to double the market's performance? Probably not. It's getting to a sort of a size now that's not likely. But will you do extremely well? I think so. I don't own any, by the way, other than through maybe a US-based ETF, which I probably do have exposure to. But, I should. I don't have a good reason why I don't.
Don't let me stop you, mate. You feel free to go and buy the shares whenever you want.
I think I've got some exposure. I just focus on the ASX. But I'm not going to fault you for it.
Yeah, so look, I that's a nice summary, mate. I think a couple of things, actually. We've already talked about a few things. The first thing I will mention is it's actually not the biggest company in the US, but it is the US company with the largest net asset value. So in terms of the, you know, think about the big companies that are bigger, like Apple and Amazon, Facebook's I think might be bigger now, their actual physical asset value is almost zero, right? Because they say they've got a couple of servers and a couple of seats and that's pretty much it compared to their value. Berkshire is a business that is made up of a whole lot of old school industrial companies. So in terms of the asset value it owns, it literally has the largest physical asset value of any company in the US, which is something. I want to say it's also the largest employer, private employer.
Yeah, I think it might be.
A stupidly large number of people work for Berkshire. It's such a big conglomerate now. For those who don't know the business super well, I'm not going to go through it in detail because it'd take me all day. Berkshire Hathaway was originally a cotton mill way back in the day.
And a terrible investment.
Hathaway company. It was, yeah.
And it was an awful investment, like in and of itself. Like it's become this holding company, but the textile business was, Buffett always talks about how much he regrets buying it.
Yeah, exactly. Had he bought the actual businesses rather than Berkshire Hathaway itself, he would have been much, much richer. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So that's where the name comes from. It's now a holding company, a conglomerate. It's an enormous conglomerate. It has a whole lot of wholly owned businesses, a few partially owned businesses, and a decently sized equity portfolio, so owns shares. Famously owns Coca-Cola, American Express, Apple, among others. It's a business run by Warren Buffett, the world's best ever investor, and Charlie Munger, who frankly would be much better known if it wasn't for Warren, and also much better known had he not given a whole lot of money away to charity and do a whole lot of stuff outside the equity markets. So he's an absolute genius as well. We both love Charlie. It's a business. So to your point about jockey play, Ram, I think it's a challenging one to talk about because the reasons for buying it when I first bought shares, I want to say 15 years ago maybe, are different to maybe why you might buy them now because of Warren Buffett's age. I think part of the story is, you know, right now if you're buying it as a jockey play, Warren, they're both over 90, right? There's not that much left for either of them at the helm. Hopefully they live long and happy lives. Will they still be running the business when they're 100? I don't know. Will they make it to 100? I don't know. So to some degree, the kind of jockey play part of the thesis is diminishing over time. Mm. 15 years ago, great reason to do it. It's now not as much. But that's okay. So in terms of so that's why it's a difficult question to answer. I know it's a very simple one, a simple question to ask, which is, hey, what's the thesis? Thesis for holding is probably different from the thesis of why I bought in the first place. I think that Berkshire has above average assets in terms of its operating businesses, and why I'm actually not worried about Warren and Charlie dying, despite the fact, as you say, Ram, the share price will probably fall when they die because people will freak out, and that's fine. The operating businesses are so incredibly strong. You're actually not paying much. When you buy Berkshire, you're not paying much for Warren and Charlie's, believe it or not, expertise. You would think they should be worth a fortune. You're actually not paying that much for them because you're getting those shares. You're getting those operating businesses. They own insurance companies. They own finance companies. They own all sorts of operating businesses. The Oriental Trading Company is one of them. They own a relocatable home manufacturing business. They own 90-something percent of an energy business called Berkshire Hathaway Energy. This is a massive conglomerate. So the value of those businesses, the cash flow for those businesses, I think, frankly, the Warren and Charlie premium is almost zero right now. You're getting really good value for the companies. I think they are above average assets, so I think they'll do better than ETF over time. Not hugely better, to your point, Ram. It is so big now. It almost couldn't do that much better without eventually being the whole market itself. But I think it'll do very well over time. It's a great bottom drawer holding. It is a great bedrock foundational position for your portfolio. I sleep very, very, very well knowing that I'm getting the assets and I'm getting Warren and Charlie for free. And then, as you say, their eventual replacements. They've got a group of guys doing the investing. Two guys, Todd and Ted, Todd Combs and Ted Weschler. They've got AJ Jane and Greg Abel running the business in the operation and insurance parts. Warren and Charlie feel great about those guys. I feel great about those guys almost by definition because of that, but even independently. Mm. And look, yeah, you won't get the Buffett premium. You won't get the Buffett deals. Berkshire is definitely a less attractive company post-Warren because Warren's Warren, right? It's like, you pick the best at anything and say, once that person leaves the stage, can it be as valuable? No, by definition it can't because the replacements won't be as good. That's almost, axiomatic. It must be true. But I own it because I think it's a great holding position. I haven't added to it in ages for what it's worth. But I love having it in my portfolio. If I am fortunate enough, I hope to pass the shares down to my kids long after Warren and Charlie have left this mortal coil. I think it'll be just a long-term compounding machine. Soul Patts is a similar one, right? So I mentioned Soul Patts on Friday, mate, and I own that one too. It's one of those businesses, even when we recommended it at ShareAdvisor, people are like, well, why would you buy that? Why wouldn't you buy the businesses that make it up? Or why wouldn't you buy more exciting businesses or whatever? And that's a reasonable question. It's outperformed the market over 1, 3, 5, 10, and 15 years. And it's kind of like, you know what? I'm happy to have boring if I get outperformance. If I can get outperformance for 15 years, it's kind of one of those things like, how much harder do you want to make life? Because it's not that hard. Buy Soul Patts, beat the market. Okay, cool. Done. There's no guarantee, of course, but, could I have tried to buy super high tech, stuff or mining or retail or, yeah, I could have, but I got the minerals looking after me. I'm happy to, entrust a portion of my portfolio to their management supervision. Same with Berkshire. I feel really, really good about having it as part of my portfolio. You also get some US exposure. You get some currency and diversification through industry exposure to other stuff we don't have here. So overall, very, very happy owning Berkshire Hathaway.
Cool.
Anything more on that, mate?
No, I think we've sold the hell out of that.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, mate, I don't really want to share Nick's question, but I will.
Okay.
Nick says, hi, Scott. I love the podcast and think you're not only incredibly smart, you're also incredibly handsome. Now, Andrew, I just want you to confirm that's actually what Nick has written here. I've taken the screenshot. You can see it. We're through the magic of Google Docs. You can see the question from Nick. Can you just confirm that Nick's actually said exactly what I've just read?
Well, it is hard to detect tone in the written word, but yes, those are the words that are printed on the page.
I don't like what you're inferring, so I'm going to assume he's being genuine and keep moving. All right. He says, now that the obligatory flattery is out of the way, which is probably more the point, I've got a mailbag question for you. What is Chi-X? And I thought rather than answer it myself, I'd make you answer the difficult question. What's Chi-X, Andrew?
I'm going to get lost if you push me too far into the details, but it's another market.
Yep.
So the ASX runs the stock market in Australia. Well, it owns one of the stock markets in Australia. Yep. Chi-X is an alternate to that. Some companies are listed on both. Some are listed on only one or the other. But it's just a different place. It's like you can buy prawns at the Sydney Seafood Market and you can also buy it at, well, I can't think of another market in Sydney, but I'm sure there are other ones that are around there. So right. Your broker will be decided. I think they've actually legally required to try and source the best available price for you. There's certain rules that are around that. But you kind of don't really need to worry about it too much, whether it's sort of whether the person who's selling you your shares is doing it through Chi-X or the ASX. You're still getting the same thing. You're buying actually the exact same thing, and the broker will just source it from wherever they can that gets you the best price. And because of that, because of all the brokers doing that, there's not much of an arbitrage opportunity there, because any gap, if CSL is trading at 301 on Chi-X and 200 on ASX, well, someone's going to buy as much as they can on one and sell it straight away on the other and make free money. And free money doesn't tend to exist for too long in capitalist systems. So, well, would you add anything? What would you say about it?
No, I think it's exactly what you said, mate. It's just a parallel market place of exchange. And so it's all about competition. It's all about keeping prices down. For the same reason, there's more than one stockbroker. In theory, the world would only need one stockbroker, because if I want to buy and you want to sell, Andrew, we could both use, Dodgy Brothers Incorporated to buy and sell our shares, and they could charge us $1,000 because they're the only mob in town. Mm. Now there is a million stockbrokers around. You can trade for less than $10 a trade. And so, the theory is simply, if you have competition when it comes to the market on which your shares are traded, as well as the broker you use, hopefully that means lower prices for everybody, more efficient market for everybody. I'm not 1,000,000% convinced it's actually necessary and needed, I have to say. I don't know that it was that badly inefficient or broken that we needed a Chi-X, but it's not a bad thing. There's no downside to it, so we might as well have it.
Yeah. Yep. There are certain businesses that are natural monopolies. Monopolies aren't always a good thing on their own. Mm. And people tend to recognize that, and governments recognize that, which is why when there are natural monopolies, they tend to be very, very, very highly regulated. And the ASX is regulated pretty heavily as well. But yeah, if in theory it helps bring more efficiency and outcomes for investors, then it's a good thing. I've got to tell you, I've used the ASX's services in some ways, and I haven't seen the price really been affected too much by Chi-X. So maybe it's not as efficient as it could be, but that's another kettle of worms.
It would be the first market where two players both made a lot of money rather than actually competing each other's profits away.
Cozy duopoly, perhaps.
You said that, not me. Hey, another question from another Nick, mate. Hi, Scott. I'm very new to the world of trading and have been smashing through the pods. I'm also a member of ShareAdvisor. Thanks, Nick. I had a quick query regarding NVIDIA. Now, that's the US-based graphics processing unit maker. It does a whole lot of graphics engines, graphics chips, using things like Tesla and some gaming, literally video game machines. I just saw, says Nick, that it had a stock split and the price has plummeted. I have shares in NVIDIA, and therefore it looks like I've taken a massive loss. I was just wondering what a stock split means and whether I need to do anything further about it. Will I gain further shares over time, or what is the way they deal with stock splits? Sorry if I haven't explained properly, but hopefully you might be able to help out. That's from Nick. Mate, can I say the finance industry finds a lot of ways to make things really complex for people, doesn't it? Like, this could be such a simple business, but you'd almost think that people made money from making this difficult. Maybe that's too sarcastic. So stock splits. Has Nick just done his dough?
No. But basically, it's the analogy we always give is the pizza is the pizza. It's whatever diameter is.
So NVIDIA is a pizza.
It's a pizza, and I can chop it up into. I can leave it as a whole pizza. And I can chop it up into 2 bits, 4 bits, 100 million bits. But I've always got the same amount of pizza, right? Mm-hmm. So the argument is often that investment bankers get involved and they say, the share price is too high. If we split it up...
That's quality, mate. When the sentence starts with investment bankers get involved, that someone's making out and it's not us, but keep going.
Well, the argument is, which might be true in some situations, is that at very high prices, it gets too expensive. So, $500 a share and I've only got $1,000, I can buy 2 shares. Or they could split that into a 5-for-1 share split and take every existing share and split it into 5 pieces. It will send the price down fivefold, but it's balanced, of course, by the fact that you get extra shares. So it all, and they'll do that because it supposedly helps liquidity. It means that there's more action traded on the market. I don't think that is true in a lot of cases. Sometimes you see the opposite, which is a stock consolidation, where you see stocks that get, the real penny stocks that get down to a fraction of a cent. Mm. And they need to say, we'll do a 10-for-1
consolidation.
Thank you. Consolidation. And I'll just do the same magic trick, or they'll just join multiple pieces of pizza into one. It doesn't really make much of a difference. You haven't lost a cent.
Yep, that's important. So basically, Nick, think about your pizza example. If you had two pieces of pizza, if a pizza was $20 and cut into two, they'd be $10 each. If you take each of those slices and halve them again, the price per slice would go from 10 to 5, and you go, oh my God, I've lost half my money. But instead of having one $10 slice, you've got two $5 slices. In other words, your shareholding hasn't changed. There's just a lower price and more pieces, but
your ownership doesn't change. Yep. And just from a practical standpoint, Nick, it should just all magically appear in your account. Yep. So you don't need to fill out any forms or do anything. Sometimes you will have the opportunity to vote on whether you think that's a good idea, but unless you're a very major shareholder, that vote's probably not going to have much of an impact anyway. So you just roll with the punches.
As you say, Ram, whether it gets up or not, you end up with the same shareholding. You've got $1,000 worth of shares. You can have $1,001 shares or $1,000 shares or $110 shares. It's all the same thing.
Mate, it sounds pretty obvious when we explain it out, but I've got to tell you, more often than I'm comfortable with, I've had people say, oh, I'd like to buy... CSL's always a classic example, one of the great Aussie companies, and people go, oh, yeah, but it's so expensive. Yeah. And they're not saying expensive because of a price or earnings multiple or expensive relative to its true actual intrinsic value. They're saying expensive because there are other stocks on the ASX trading at 50 cents. Yep. But it's a furphy, and it's surprising how often it catches people out. Honestly, even if you are the smallest of small investors and you've got $1,000 to invest, you know, there'll be a little bit of a rounding issue there as well. But it's never really going to make a difference. With Berkshire, just to go back to that, it does make when each one of your shares is worth $200,000, now the investment bankers have got an argument, you know, to sort of say this is hard for people to get in and out. But for most share prices, I don't think it's much ado about nothing is what it is.
So, mate, I just had a look. The Berkshire Hathaway Class A shares currently, $418,975 US.
I was out by a factor of two.
So what's that, 600 grand Australian, something like that for a single, for one. Imagine putting order for one share, having a hand over 600 grand for it. I can see why people balk at that sort of thing.
Do you remember this, a massive tangent here? Where you and I went to Omaha for the 50th anniversary of Berkshire Hathaway. And one of the things you do, which is a horrible touristy thing to do, but you know, when in Rome, we were there and you go and do a drive-by past Uncle Woz's house. And so we did, invaded the poor man's privacy. It's a very, very modest house, which is famous for. But interestingly, what I remember is that across the road, there was a house for sale. And they didn't have the price in dollars on there. The price to buy the house, I think it was like two Berkshire Hathaway shares, whatever that was at the time. And so, the owners were saying, "Well, you can buy the house, but we're not accepting cash. We want whatever it was, two or three Berkshire shares."
That was brilliant, wasn't it?
That was so cool,
mate. These days, probably bloody Bitcoin. But that's a whole different conversation. And Berkshire Hathaway does have a Class A and Class B for exactly that reason. And back in the day, Buffett did it originally because fund managers were actually creating a fund and let you buy fractional Berkshire shares because they were so expensive.
Yeah.
And so he's like, well, hang on, I'm not going to let anyone profit off this. I'll split the shares myself. Mm. He'd actually split them. He created a second class of share and did it that way. But same broad idea. It is funny though, mate. I think I kind of half take your point about, you know, the price per share being too high and scaring people off. Mm. Except we've just finished answering a question about fractional shares. And these days, if nothing else, if you can go to your broker and buy a tenth of an NVIDIA share, or a 1/100th of a Berkshire share, which I'm sure you can do, it really does it makes it even less defensible, surely, to split shares just for the hell of it.
Yeah.
Which, though, takes me to the next question, because for all of that, and we're right, because of course we're right, we're smart, capable people, but Dana actually asks us a question, and this one actually, I assume, Dana, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name, comes from the US, or at least I'm assuming so, because it starts here. I listened to the Motley Fool Australia podcast, and the prices on the ASX seem so much lower than on the Dow. For example, Telstra is at $3.75. Is there a mandatory fractional share required? And I thought this was a great question because it's kind of asking the exact point we're just making from the opposite perspective where, you know, in the US, if a share is less than $5 each, they consider those penny shares these days, right? So there's that idea of like if it's under $5, well, it's not worth buying because obviously it's a crap business. Yeah. On the other hand, as we said, we've just talked about Berkshire being $400,000 a share. In Australia, a $100 share is expensive. Even a $35 share for many people seems too high to pay. Well, I can buy this one for 20 cents or this one for $30. Why would I pay $30 for a share? I'd rather pay for 20 for all the same reasons. Yeah. And Dana or Dana is asking exactly the same question in reverse, which is, man, they look low. What's going on there? And it's just funny how we get used to certain prices, right? And all of the things for all of we like to pretend we're rational a lot of the time, and other investors are rational. The reality is this very topic is exactly, and the investment bankers aren't doing it for their own, at a love, right? They're doing it because they know that different investors work a certain way. The Yanks know if shares are less than $5, that's too cheap. Australians, if we've got to pay more than $30, think that's too expensive. The reality simply is neither is actually true at all because, as you say, you can make Berkshire Hathaway a cent a share if you issue enough shares. If you split Berkshire Hathaway shares enough times, it's a $3.75 share, the same as Telstra. If you consolidate Telstra 1,000 times, you've got a $3,000 Telstra share. Doesn't change the value of the company, but the investment community does genuinely think differently about those things. Despite everything we know, it still has that impact, doesn't it?
It's a purely cultural thing.
It is funny, isn't it?
It's entirely cultural.
You think, man, this is money and it's rational and how can it be cultural? But it really is.
Yeah, I'm sure the Yanks look at the ASX and go, wow, everything's so low in price. And we look over there and there's no right or wrong. You know, it's funny, like potato.
Tomato.
Exactly. All right.
Not a good excuse to make him print, of course, because it's very hard to explain the difference in pronunciation when you explain it the same way. But yeah, Dana, there's no difference. In fact, there is no requirement. It is purely, it is absolutely purely cultural. If you had an Australian, if you're launching an Australian company in the ASX today, you'd list it for what? Probably a dollar, Andrew? $2? Like
It's dollars. You
that price.
A very common IPO price is a dollar. It doesn't have to be, but it is definitely set because they feel as though that is a palatable price for whatever psychological reason. That's it.
People are just used to it.
Yep. Purely mathematically arbitrary.
Correct. That's the other thing, right? I think we've talked about this before. I think maybe I did it with Doc. You could actually just rebase every stock on the ASX or the New York Stock Exchange or both to $1,000 or a dollar each.
Yeah,
tomorrow.
Easy. Yep.
You can arbitrarily just say, and you know what? You know what? People would behave differently. It'll never happen, but I'd love to see the experiment where everyone says, right, BHP and Afterpay and Commonwealth Bank and CSL and some tin pot miner, they're all worth a dollar a share. Now, which ones do you want to buy? And I guarantee you people would do things differently, which, again, has no base in rational reality at all, but I guarantee you people would buy CSL or CBA or BHP differently if they're all a dollar a share.
Yep. I think so. And I think probably the immediate reaction would be that people that saw stocks go from 50 cents to a dollar would think, oh, wow, something's going really well here. And those that went from 300 to a dollar, people go, oh, something's going wrong. Share price is sold off. Yeah.
Isn't that? They're not a quality company anymore because it's the same price, only a dollar.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, we also cheer when, you know, CBA says it'll go through $200 a share. As if it means something, it's all pretty random.
Yeah.
All right. Last one for today, mate. It's a meaty one. I love this question from Craig because it gets into some really – we talk about tech on Friday. So here's the question. Hi, Scott and Sage Simeon. I will share our Twitter handles in a minute, but there's a hint. Many years ago, says Craig, I read an investor presentation put out by the accounting software company Xero. If memory serves me correctly, they stated it cost them roughly $400 to sign up a new customer. Each customer paid around $40 a month, and so after 10 months, the cost of getting that customer was covered. And the average customer lasted about 9 years. Now, lots of numbers so far. This is hard to do in audio, but just stick with us. So $400 to acquire, $40 a month, 10 months, $400. So they've made their money back in 10 months. But the customer hangs around for 9 years. You can see where Craig's going here. They also stated, says Craig, their software was so beautiful, they were growing their customer numbers at 30% per year. After reading these numbers, I could understand why they were not profitable at the time. But in future years, I thought the profits would come rolling in. I thought, wow, investing in this company is a no-brainer. Unfortunately, he says, I didn't have a brain. I thought investing can't be this simple, and I didn't invest. And the shares were trading at $16 at the time. I think they're over $100 now. Sorry, Craig. What I didn't understand, I think, was that Xero was clearly explaining the company's unit economics. It's a term I've heard expert investors with great track records mention when they're looking at companies to invest in. I was wondering for the podcast if I could get the thoughts of you two wise gentlemen on the subject of unit economics. Love the podcast and full on. That's coming from Craig. Now, I'm going to start, Ram, by saying I'm not sure that that is actually unit economics the way we traditionally explain it or understand it. Unit economics is normally a store by store, unit by unit, as in a retail unit or a physical unit, as opposed to what this is, which is more about the cost of acquisition and the lifetime value of a customer. Do you want to break those down for me?
Oh, man, this is another great question, but a huge one. So you'll hear, when you start investing, particularly in software companies, you'll hear these terms like CAC and LTV, so client acquisition cost and lifetime value. And as long as the maths is pretty basic, as long as the LTV is bigger than the CAC, well then, you know, you'll spend money every day. And I think what it took a long time for the market to get a handle on was just how lovely that is when it moves forward. The trouble is in day one, let's say that back in the day, what was he saying, 2016 or whenever it was, so that they were doing this and they would want a gazillion customers that year. Yeah. Now, they had to pay $400 for each of those gazillion customers. Yeah. So all of this money has just flowed out of the business.
$400 gazillion.
You know, times 400, whatever it was. And yes, they're going to make it back, but it doesn't show up in year one, your year two. And I mean, in year nine, well, the money that you spent to acquire the customer has long been spent. But year after year after year after year, just keep cutting these, more and more money just keeps coming in. So it's beautiful. This is why the market is usually so happy to tolerate cash burning, fast growing companies with big addressable markets, because they know that they will reach a point where they hit an inflection point and break through to profitability, and the unit economics just work really, really, really well. So I would say to Craig, don't beat yourself up too badly, because in investing, things always look super clear and super obvious in hindsight. So yes, they were saying those things during their presentations, but there were other companies. Reckon was saying the same kind of thing, right? That we're going to grow fast and we've got the same business. And it didn't happen because the lifetime value wasn't as good and the client acquisition cost was a bit higher and the fixed cost components of the business. So you know, just because they're going with this model doesn't mean it's going to work. But the lesson is that when it does work, it is really, really, really beautiful. And the other thing is, as well, you got to remember these lifetime values, you know, 9 years average customer life. They actually quoting these numbers before they've actually had a client for 9 years.
That's right.
They're just extrapolating recent retention rates out into the future. Yep. So it might not be. So again, so it's don't beat yourself up too much. But honestly, when I love these kinds of companies, when I see these kinds of opportunities where you can push that forward and you feel as though they are legitimate in being able to end up with a large part of the market, which I think Xero's got an excellent chance of doing. So take the lesson and as I said before, don't anchor necessarily on what was the, you know, that was then, this is now. Yeah. But I haven't done the work recently on Xero, so I don't know. But potentially, it could still be good value. And if it's not, you may will find that, you know, next year, or next month, or next week, or who knows, you will get an opportunity because of some random thing on the market. But yeah, what a thing of beauty! Don't you love to see that kind of thesis play out?
Glorious, isn't it? I will also add some thoughts. I'll try not to overdo what you've already done, but. Craig, I'll agree with Andrew's point. The first thing is you couldn't have known then that they were going to be successful, because plenty have fallen by the wayside. And one of the worst things you can do as an investor, and we've used the example before, mate, just because someone won the lottery doesn't mean playing it was a good idea.
Yep.
So you can't go, oh, well, of course I should have played the lottery because look, someone won $1 million.
Well, if you picked those numbers, you would have too. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and you could have known in advance and all that kind of stuff. Right. So don't beat yourself up too much. As you say, there was a lot of doubt in that investment thesis at the time. That's what they were trying to do. Now, it turns out they did well. Some people made some money because they followed that idea. So I'm not saying you couldn't have known necessarily. But as Andrew says, Reckon and plenty of other companies offered the same sort of idea. Just because those economics are real, by the way, their customer growth could have gone to zero, could have gone backwards. Someone could have come, Reckon could have actually beaten them to the punch, and we could be talking about the Reckon story using the same numbers, and Xero is now a broken, forgotten business that was hopefully going to do some good. So there's that. The other thing too is, for what it's worth, the Xero was the first business in Australasia to really do this. And so you were kind of forgiven for not really getting it, mate. Yes, you're right. It looked like a no-brainer. I've given my Afterpay no-brainer story before, which is looking at the numbers that they were delivering massive growth for retail customers, and I just went, oh yeah, that's really great, and didn't do anything about it. So, mate, I'm with you. But yeah, look, hindsight always 2020 at the time. Could you have known? Should you have known? Was it absolutely always going to be provable and obvious? No, because that's what they hoped to do or wanted to do. And as Andrew said, they didn't have 9 years with the history. So that was guesswork. They basically would say, look, and here's the way they do 9 years of lost customer life, right? They'd say, we lose 10% of our customers every year. So therefore, if you lose 10% of your customers every year, the average customer's hanging around for 10 years. Now, is that necessarily true? No, because you don't know that you might lose 10% of your customers for the first 2 years and lose all of them in year three. So there's extrapolating. Again, they weren't lying. They weren't doing anything wrong, but you weren't wrong to not necessarily believe this was a fait accompli, because it simply wasn't. You're dead right.
The other thing that you got to watch too, I think Live Tiles might be an example of this, where
the unit economics are brilliant, but at the same time, the cost, but the fixed cost base of the business continues to grow. That's so they add more and more developers, you know, just the administration costs. So, and you can tell too, but just by look at what the company focuses on and all its slide decks, you know, presentations to the ASX. if all they're talking about that, but you know, they really go out of their way to not talk about the actual statutory profit results and casual, you know, they're directing you there for a given reason. So yeah, just another thing. But I think Craig's right. He's noticed something that's really valuable. I think a lot of people still don't fully grasp that when that model works really well. So you'll see the same kind of things with real estate online, with Seek, you know, with all of those kinds of business. They really, really cool economics. And when they do, and they're all examples of when they go well, it's great. Yep. It really is.
So, Craig, keep an eye out for these sort of businesses. You're looking – so let me break some of this down. Andrew's already talked about the cost of acquisition or CAC, a customer acquisition cost. You want to know what that is. I will say The Motley Fool has a customer acquisition cost which is in excess of our first-year subscription most of the time because we know people tend to hang around. They tend to buy other products. That's not giving anything away that wasn't already in the public domain, or at least not assumable or guessable. So it's a very reasonable approach. But it carries its own risk because you're burning cash, as Andrew's already said. You may not keep the customer for as long as you think. If they'd spent $400 to acquire a customer, the average customer, say, for 5 months, well, guess what? The more they spent, the more money they lost. And new customers can often stay for less time. So if you have a low-hanging fruit strategy, the first lot of customers you sign up are the ones who are probably the dyed-in-the-wool true believers. Will they stay longer than the average customer? Yeah, probably. If I was starting a new business and I got the 400 people who were keenest and love me most, I can assume they will stay longer than the average customer I signed up in year four, who I've spent 4 years trying to acquire, who don't really love me that much, but are happy to give me a go. So again, we're going to be careful of the changing nature of those economics. So that's customer acquisition cost. Lifetime value, as you rightly point out, Andrew's already mentioned, is simply the amount of money they spend with you times the length of time they spend with you. So $100 a year for 10 years, lifetime value of $1,000. Pretty obvious there. Interesting to think about. So churn, customer churn is another thing to look at. And that's a different way to calculate the lifetime value or the lifetime, I should say, of the customer. That is, how long will they be with you? If you can keep your churn over 90, ideally over 95%, that's a wonderful business. If your customers are that sticky, they're going to hang around almost entirely all the time. You can extrapolate into the future with a really, really nice ability to understand that. But you again also need that growth, right? Even if zero didn't grow, but still there's wonderful economics, it's kind of worth the terminal value because the customer base didn't grow, and then it's just a cash generation question. If you grow, that's a whole different thing. And again, you want to see that growth as well as those other mechanics other metrics come into play. So that's really, really important. So I think that's something you really should think about. Things like, and this is where Xero was also difficult to understand, they were spending a squillion bucks on marketing. And so when you think about valuing a business like Xero, you've kind of got to try and work through, okay, what does some sort of steady state look like? Because as you rightly point out, just looking at LTV and customer acquisition cost might have been enough, but at some point they don't keep growing. And so you've got to try and kind of work out how much is worth paying. If the shares now were $5,000 each for Xero, they're about $100. Let's say they're $5,000 and the economics were exactly the same, I wouldn't buy it with Andrew's money.
God, no.
And so there was still a price, right? There's still a math need to be done. So even a business with one of economics, you can still have too high a price to pay.
Yeah.
And there's no easy way to do that, but you just need to think about that because I think a lot of investors actually make the mistake saying, hey, this has got a model like Xero's, and Andrew already mentioned Reckon. Hey, look, you know, that's the same sort of business, I should buy Reckon. Well, it's done nowhere near as well because it couldn't get the growth that Andrew was looking for and also the scale. So when you get to a certain scale, your fixed costs are the same, your revenue grows and grows and grows. That's what they call operating leverage, and that's where you get revenue growth in excess of cost growth. And if you can grow your revenue faster than your costs over and over and over again, your profit goes absolutely through the roof. And that's the other thing that comes with unit economics, to Andrew's point and to your question, Craig, was unit economics are really where the individual, normally in retail they talk about unit economics with individual store level economics, for example. Because again, if you can get individual stores to do well, you're covering the fixed costs really easily. And the more you can grow that number of units, in this case, the better the financial results. But you've got to be able to deliver on that unit economics or in the software world on that operating leverage, because if you can, then as you say, when the steady state comes, that marketing cost drops away and you're just harvesting cash. That's the business you need to understand. And so I'm like you, Andrew. I've looked at Xero a few times at the current price and I'm not convinced it's not good value. I'm not convinced it is good value just yet. It hasn't yet hit the scorecard of Motley Fool Share Advisor. But it is a business that we've looked at more than once and gone, I wonder how much growth is left. I wonder what the economics look like when they start to roll back that marketing cost. You don't want to do it soon because you want to acquire those customers while ever the LTV is greater than the CAC. You want to go hard as they can at acquiring customers. So you don't want them to roll back the marketing. But again, as Andrew said, that's where new age businesses are harder to analyze, right, than the old ones, because they're going to lose money for a long time. Amazon's another great example, right? They have spent 25 years acquiring customers, making almost no money, while they've just built this fortress of a business, which is cheapest, biggest, fastest with most customers. They've willingly foregone, you know, profits last year, the year before, 10 years before that, because they wanted to build this juggernaut business, which they've built, same as Xero. You've just got to make sure they're going to get there, and that's not an easy thing to assume in advance. Very easy to see in hindsight, easy to kick yourself, but don't be too hard on yourself, mate. It wasn't that obvious to that many people. Otherwise, everyone would already own Xero. Any more on that, mate?
No, all good.
Now, Craig called you Sage Simeon, which give us an indication. It might be your Twitter handle. In fact, your Twitter handle is Sage_Simeon, or your company Twitter handle is Strawman Invest, if I'm not mistaken. Is that
that's
right?
That's it. Yep, that's the one.
So hit Andrew up. Follow him on Twitter, Sage_Simeon. What does that mean? Funny monkey or something? What does it mean?
Wise monkey. And so I don't know what I was thinking, but I did it when I first joined Twitter and I kind of have been stuck with it. So
you know what I love is you've never actually gone to change it. You've kind of gone, I don't know why I chose it, but bugger it, I'm sticking with it.
Can you change your handle? I genuinely didn't know.
Is that right?
I didn't know. I thought you could, okay. Maybe I will. I know. Look, I've stuck with it for this long. I'm not giving up now.
Hit him up on Sage_Simeon this week because it might be different next week.
God, I'm so plugged in.
Or Strawman Invest. You can hit me up at TMFScottP. The Motley Fool is at The Motley Fool AU. If you're on Instagram, those handles are the same for me and for The Fool. You're not yet on Instagram, are you, Andrew?
Never.
Not yet. Also,
no, not yet.
Your new Twitter handle should be Ram_Page. Is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, it's not bad. I like that.
We'll talk afterwards. If you're on Instagram, TMF Scott P or The Motley Fool AU. If you're on Facebook, The Motley Fool Australia or Scott Phillips Money. And if you want to email us, you can do that info@fool.com.au. Mate, all the best with Strawman Premium. Excited to see how well that's already going. And
thanks,
mate. I'm sure it'll be bigger and better. So that's awesome. If you do want to check out The Motley Fool, feel free to do that as well. So strawman.com. or fool.com.au. Hit us up on any of those socials. We want more questions for next week. We'll be back on Wednesday with the Stock of the Week. Andrew and I will be back next Friday and then next Sunday with a mailbag. We've got a busy week coming up, mate. Until then, Fool on.
See you next time.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.